Welcome back to Lungcast, the monthly respiratory health podcast series from the American Lung Association and medical news site hcplive.com. I'm your host, Dr. Albert Rizzo, the Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Before we introduce our topic and our guest today, just a reminder that Lungcast is available on all your favorite streaming platforms. Subscribe to @Lungcast on YouTube to get new and archived episodes, as well as interview segments and episode highlights as they come out. A link to the show page, as well as the ALA and HCP Live homepages for Lungcast, can be found in each episode description. For those of you who prefer a podcast, you can subscribe to Lungcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and your favorite listening platforms. You can also register for more respiratory news and insights at both lung.org and hcplive.com. Today's discussion is on important updates in the diagnosis and management of COPD. As of 2024, in the United States, COPD affects more than 14 million adults, and there are likely many more people who have COPD that are not yet diagnosed. Let me review a few other facts regarding COPD. It's currently the sixth leading cause of death in the United States and fourth globally. More than half of the people diagnosed with COPD in the United States are women, and COPD rates are higher in rural areas than in urban areas. Tobacco smoking remains the major cause of COPD and accounts for over 70% of COPD cases in high-income countries. Household air pollution is a major risk factor for COPD in low- and middle-income countries. And 14% of COPD cases are occupational in nature, caused by exposure to vapors, gases, dusts, and fumes in the workplace. Today's discussion is going to focus on the 2025 updates in the GOLD guidelines for COPD. The Global Initiative for Obstructive Lung Disease, or GOLD, was launched back in 1997 in collaboration with the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, National Institutes of Health, and the World Health Organization. This collaboration determines management guidelines for COPD care, shaped by committees made up of leading experts from around the world. We're fortunate to have one of those experts with us today. Dr. Gerard Criner is Chair and Professor, Thoracic Medicine and Surgery at the Lewis Katz School of Medicine and Director of the Temple Lung Center in Philadelphia. Dr. Criner is also on the GOLD Board of Directors and the GOLD Science Committee. He and the Temple Lung Center have been hosting a yearly meeting in Philadelphia that showcases the GOLD updates with faculty from around the world. Many of our listeners may remember we hosted Dr. Criner back in 2022, Lungcast, and we thought it appropriate to have him back to discuss important updates that have occurred in COPD and the GOLD guidelines since that episode. Thank you for being with us today, Dr. Criner.
Thanks, Dale, for having me. I appreciate it.
So the 2025 Global Initiative for Chronic Obstructive Lung Disease report introduced several updates. I would like your perspective on a few of them. Spirometry remains a key diagnostic tool in COPD, and there's a section in the guidelines that speak to the trajectories of FEV1 over a lifetime, and also talks about dysanapsis in the same section. Terms such as early, mild, young, pre-COPD, and PRISM are used to identify patients. Please explain to our listeners what these terms are used for, what they mean.
Yeah, a lot of different terms. So the goal for COPD during my career has been trying to change the trajectory of the disease. And that's very difficult when you only start to identify patients and diagnose them when they're older and they have fixed airways obstruction and there's very little reversibility that you can induce. So the idea, and from some of the more recent studies over the last two decades, is all patients with COPD are not the same. They don't get to the point of airflow obstruction. They come from different avenues. Some of them have developmental abnormalities from when the early neonatal development. Some of them have it in adolescence. Some of them have environmental or genetic predisposition. So not everyone comes at COPD at the same point in their life or for the same reason. So the idea is to really capture the broader group of patients at a time in their life where they may have reversible elements that could be targets for treatment or targets for avoidance of hazards or identification prognostically of having a greater likelihood of developing COPD later in life, so that you could intercede and do something that would avoid them ending up with fixed airflow obstruction at the age of 60 or 70 years of age. So some of those concepts are kind of the terms that you mentioned. So early means early in the biologic process, not so much a clinical term, but means a process is happening earlier in their stage of development of COPD that may be indicating a biologic process or a risk factor that could be interceded with. Mild means mainly mild airflow obstruction, maybe not severe airflow obstruction. So it really is a gradation of airflow obstruction. Young means people that start to develop forms of COPD or COPD risk at the age of 20 to 50, not at the age of 60 to 70 years of age. And I think out of the terms, the most important one may be pre-COPD, because pre-COPD captures a group of patients that may have structural abnormalities or symptoms, but yet do not have fixed airflow obstruction. So that would be people who come in for lung cancer screening, and on their CAT scan, 25% of them will have symptoms of cough or mucus production or shortness of breath, but they don't have fixed airflow obstruction with an FEV1 FVC less than 70%. Or they could have structural evidence of emphysema, or they could have symptoms alone. So pre-COPD is capturing a group of people who are at risk because of symptoms and because of structural abnormalities to develop COPD defined by fixed airflow obstruction later in life. And PRISM is another form of that. PRISM are really people with an FEV1 that's reduced. It's 80% less than normal, but they don't have evidence of fixed airflow obstruction. And this patient group is mainly people with metabolic disorders. People might be overweight, and they may have more likely have cardiovascular disease or diabetes or hypertension, and have a greater likelihood of developing COPD in our lifetime, 10 to 30%, and have definite morbidity and mortality. But the features of their disease that drives their outcome is more related to those factors of obesity or diabetes or heart disease. So all of it is an attempt to encapsulate the group of patients that have different forms or different pathways that leading to fixed airflow obstruction later in their life, so we could intercede in a favorable way earlier on in their disease process.
Makes perfect sense. That's a broad net that you're throwing out there to gather all these individuals. The mainstay for the initial therapy for COPD still remains the role of bronchodilatation. In previous guidelines, we've moved away from the four ABCD quadrants of identifying patients based on symptoms and exacerbations to direct therapy. And instead, I've noticed that combined the CD quadrants into the E group. Why was this felt to be important, and what are the implications for therapy?
The major goal of GOLD is basically distill whatever information we have from clinical trials and the best epidemiologic, pathophysiologic evidence that we have, and make it clinically relevant for someone who's seeing patients that they can adopt those recommendations. And when the ABCD classification first came out, it was always based on patient symptoms, with the severity of symptoms being an important factor, the threshold, and also the presence of exacerbations, whether more frequent, moderate, or severe. And the way the four quadrants work with ABCD was the more symptoms you had would drive you to the right, so C and D, and the more exacerbations that you had would drive you towards north, more towards C and D. And in reality, there's very few patients that have less symptoms that have frequent or severe exacerbations. So that C group became very small and always was. So in light of that, trying to make things focused on what's most important for the patient, we thought it was most important to grade the symptoms. And if you had moderate or severe exacerbations, regardless of your symptomatology, that would be captured by just labeling that group one group, which was E. So it was a point of the practicality of not many patients are asymptomatic or very low symptom burden with frequent, moderate, or severe exacerbations and trying to make something that was more clinically relevant to the practitioner.
Makes sense. So aside from the bronchodilators and certainly the inhaled corticosteroids that have a role in treatment, there were also some important pharmacologic updates talked about in the update, including the discussion on ensifentrine, which is a selective dual inhibitor of PDE3 and PDE4, and its role in reducing exacerbations. Would you please discuss this new medication and its therapy?
Sure. Well, ensifentrine is a novel compound. As you said, it's a phosphodiesterase 3 and 4 inhibitor, and its biologic mechanisms, it's a dilator and it has anti-inflammatory properties, which are unique in a sense to coin them in the same drug. So it may function as a bronchodilator, plus be important in decreasing the risk of exacerbations. And the two studies that were done that led to its approval showed that patients compared mainly to placebo or non-triple-based therapy had improvement in lung function, so it worked as a bronchodilator, and also had a favorable improvement on exacerbation reduction in two parallel six-month studies. So that gave it, you know, that unique role where it may be used as a bronchodilator in some patients that can't tolerate long-acting bronchodilators and our sole bronchodilator, long-acting bronchodilator therapy, and may have a role for decreasing exacerbations in those that should not be placed on ICS or intolerant to ICS-based therapies. Now, it's only approved in the U.S., not outside the U.S. at this point. And one of the things to note from the pivotal trials that was done, it wasn't compared to patients who had failed triple inhaled therapy. So that the impact of that drug in that patient group, the more severe patient group, really isn't known at this point.
So to make it clear for me, so it's not exactly an add-on to somebody who's on triple therapy and not doing well, but it can be used in place of the ICS or the bronchodilators in certain individuals.
Yeah. At the present time, we don't have evidence about its place on top of triple inhaled therapy.
Got it. Okay, thank you. Another important pharmacologic update has to do with the evolving role of biologics in the treatment of COPD. Can you please discuss their role in reducing exacerbations and give us some insight into the current therapies and the pipeline of drugs that may be available in the coming years?
Yeah, I think this is one of the most important new areas that we have in the management of COPD in patients that are exacerbation prone. Biologics aren't just recent developments. They've been around being studied at least since 2014, 2016. And the first studies that were done, and there were several of them, I was involved in many of them, were not successful. They had some hints of who the patient population would be, but the studies that were designed with benralizumab, the Galalithia and Terranova, both failed to meet their endpoint. The mepolizumab trials with the Metrix and Metrio, one of the trials with the eosinophilic subgroup and the intention to treat with mepolizumab did show benefit, but in a group not selected for eosinophilic predominance had no benefit. And then the Metrio trial didn't meet statistical benefit in its arm. So because of that, the FDA did not approve either of those agents in the 2018 time period. But there was extensive post hoc analysis that was done that determined clinical characteristics that may be important in defining a group that may be suffering from type 2 inflammation that may respond to these therapies. And what was found from those post hoc analysis, patients that continued to exacerbate and treated with systemic steroids for their exacerbation, who had evidence of blood eosinophil counts 300 and above, those patient groups may be those who may respond most to that therapy. So going forward, that has been the patient group that's been identified by Regeneron Sanofi for the NOTUS and BOREAS trials with the dupilumab trials, which two replicate studies published in the New England Journal showed significant improvements in exacerbation, moderate and severe reduction as a combined endpoint, an improvement in FEV1, and an improvement in quality of life. The mepolizumab study, the MATINEE study, has recently publicly announced that it met its primary endpoint of moderate and severe exacerbation, following patients out to 104 weeks. And the benralizumab trial, which also was redesigned, again, focused on this patient group that I just mentioned of more type 2 inflammation, and they should have some results for us in this coming fall. So I think this is an intriguing time for patients with COPD, where many studies that have targeted type 2 inflammation are going to, or have either resulted or in a process of being resulted, that will give us some different drugs to treat our patients. At the same time, there's other biologics that have been identified working on the alarmin pathway that are really important agents that are metabolized, secreted by the epithelium and other cells in the airway epithelium structure, such as interleukin 33, thymic stromal lipoprotein, and those drugs, which are a host of them, tozorakimab, ipatikimab, astegolimab, and tezepelumab, are now all being involved in clinical trials, looking at, is it only responsive to the peripheral blood eosinophil or not? How important the presence of current or former smoking is to pick, to select what agent might be more effective. But I think the future is that we're going to have many different agents that would be targeted directly to the patient's endotype and phenotype that may allow us to select an agent that's best for that individual patient. That would be exciting times.
That is exciting research. It's great. So let's move away from therapy a little bit. The guidelines point out the frequent coexistence of cardiovascular disease in the COPD population. It discusses the importance of recognizing it and addressing the comorbidity in both a clinically stable patient with COPD and those who are experiencing exacerbation. Could you comment further on what this recommendation means?
Yeah, we know because of shared variables, age, risk factors, smoking for sure, immobility, that patients with COPD have about 25% incidence of coronary artery disease. And we know that patients that have an exacerbation have a much greater likelihood of a major acute cardiac event or stroke within the first 90 days after they have an exacerbation, especially one that had led to a hospitalization. And we know that many patients who have COPD will have pulmonary hypertension. Pulmonary hypertension in mild to moderate exists in probably about 30 to 40% of the population with COPD. And a lot of that's due to the damage that occurs to the lung and the physiologic implications of that with COPD, with either destruction of the pulmonary vascular bed, the degree of hyperinflation causing compression of adjacent blood vessels, or the effects of hypoxemia or inflammation to not only the airway, but also to the endovascular space that contributes to the development of the pulmonary hypertension. The problem with pulmonary hypertension has been all the trials, for the most part, that we've looked at with patients with pulmonary hypertension have not been successful. We've had contradictory results with not improving patients' outcome, but actually worsening patients' outcome in a few of them. The patient subgroup of this, however, that may benefit from therapy are those with the disproportionate pulmonary hypertension that have disease that's out of the realm of mild to moderate disease that we usually see from these other physiologic variables. And those patients may be potential candidates under select circumstances for some of the newer therapies that work on prostaglandins or other forms of vasodilators that may be important for that patient group, beside oxygen, rehabilitation, and treating them for emphysema with maybe other interventions.
Good point. Thank you. As I mentioned earlier, it's likely that there are many more individuals with COPD in our population, but for various reasons, they haven't been diagnosed as yet, and therefore not able to potentially benefit from the available therapies. Despite this gap in diagnosis, we know that screening for COPD with spirometry has been controversial. And in this country, the USPSTF repeatedly does not recommend screening the general population. For our listeners, would you please clarify the distinction between screening and case finding and how you recommend the use of spirometry in clinical practice?
Yeah, you're right. The USPSTSF has not recommended the use of spirometry in routine screening based on their analysis of randomized controlled trials and some observational data. The randomized controlled trials were people selected for clinical trials where smoking burden wasn't known, et cetera. But if you look at now the studies that have focused on lung cancer screening, the prevalence of patients who are found to have airflow obstruction or risk factors for COPD are very high. They can be as high, depending on the patient population in different countries, whether it's Poland, the UK, Italy, or France, Spain, 70% of patients may have presence of airflow obstruction. And in half the patient group at those studies, they weren't detected. Therefore, the patient's symptoms were underdiagnosed and undertreated. So we feel a gold that we're not talking about recommending lung checks and spirometry done when lung cancer screening occurs. That's not against what the USPSTSF recommendation is. It's actually that we're focused on a different patient group than the USPSTSF has studied before and recommended not doing spirometry on. You well know that people getting lung cancer screening are people over the age of 50 who've smoked 20 pack years or greater. That's a much different group than what they're talking about in their recommendations. That patient group that we're talking about has not only a high risk of having airflow obstruction and pre-risk factors such as emphysema or airway inflammation, they also have a significant risk of other comorbid diseases that can be identified on lung cancer imaging now, such as presence of coronary artery calcification, pulmonary artery enlargement, the presence of interstitial lung opacities, bronchiectasis. You can also measure foregut abnormalities such as hiatal hernia, osteopenia, osteoporosis, and evidence of, of obesity. So the ramifications now of elite scanning with AI imaging gives us another tool to maximize the benefit of lung cancer screening in a patient population who smoked.
You touched on what I was going to come up with next. So today, if a referring physician has a scan done for screening and it comes back telling them physician is emphysema seen, this is a patient you recommend should be evaluated for the possibly with spirometry or other more deeper involvement of their history and physical to see if they are at risk for COPD.
That's correct, because some of their symptoms may be driven by the amount of hyperinflation they have from emphysema, or we find about 8% of the patient population screened for lung cancer in a smoking population. 8% of them have interstitial lung opacities, and some of them are going to have early markers of pulmonary fibrosis.
Very good. Thank you. So before closing, I would like you to discuss the section on proposed taxonomy or etiotypes of COPD. The guidelines indicate this taxonomy may not be important in clinical practice today, but it's an important framework to highlight current and future research and therapies in COPD.
Yeah, that's a good point. So what we're talking about in that section is the different pathways that people come in where they develop COPD, that if there are things with early lung development, such as dyskinesia could happen due to children that are born prematurely who end up having airflow obstruction because they have a disconnect between the development of the airway tree and the alveolar parenchyma, you might end up with airflow obstruction later on in life. And it's something you might want to know about and track that patient closer on. People that have biomass fuel exposure may respond differently to drugs than we do. They might have more of a different expression of more females and minorities who do most of the cooking and cleaning developing countries. You might want to look at drug therapy for patients that have biomass fuel exposure or how they respond to therapies than what we see now. And I think talking about lung cancer screening and COPD, those aren't just casual partners. There's probably some true integrative pathways of inflammation and aberrant repair, where patients who have one disease will develop the other or have it simultaneously, where we should focus on therapy, as Osler said, not just treating the disease, but treating the patient and give us better outcomes for patients overall.
Good. Well, I want to thank you for what we covered, but I wanted to also give you an opportunity to comment on some of the COPD research occurring at the Temple Lung Center.
Oh, thanks. So we have done a number of the studies we just talked about with looking at biologic therapies and triple inhaled therapies for COPD. We've done also studies involving treating patients with COPD who have chronic bronchitis, who have emphysema. There are a number of studies that are coming out this year with novel therapies. We'll have readouts out, large international multi-center trials, two of them looking at chronic bronchitis, treating them either with metered dose nitrogen cryospray to decrease goblet cell hyperplasia and mucus production, one looking at rheoplasty using pulse electrical field activity, trying again to ablate the same cell line to see if you can improve patient symptoms and secondarily improve exacerbation. There'll be a presentation at the ATS on the Airflow 3 trial, which was the use of targeted lung denervation in patients with COPD at risk for exacerbation. So all those three studies will be out this year. And there's a number of studies looking at patients who have emphysema and are hyperinflated, looking at a variety of bronchoscopic techniques where patients aren't candidates for endobronchial valve because they don't have intact fissures or have collateral ventilation. And those trials now looking at a variety of techniques, either trying to use adhesives or sclerosing agents to seal the gap and then use an endobronchial valve, or to use devices that are airway stabilizers or even thermal ablation, are studies that are soon to begin. So the exciting thing, I think, for patients with a chronic disease is there's a number of different developments, both from medicines and non-pharmacologic pathways, that are hopefully will improve their outcomes.
Sounds like a busy place, Dr. Kreiner. Thank you for that work. So I want to thank you again for today and your insights based on the important work you are doing in COPD. And to our listeners, there's much more related to the diagnosis and care of the COPD patient. And I want to encourage you to review the full 2025 Gold Report that can be read and downloaded at goldcopd.org/2025-gold-report. And as mentioned, the Temple Lung Center will be again hosting an in-person conference of COPD experts later this year in Philadelphia, I believe on November 12th and 13th. If you want to hear more regarding all things respiratory related, we have a great archive of discussions on our show feeds. And be sure again to subscribe and rate Lungcast on your preferred listening or watching platform. And visit lung.org and hcplive.com for more news and resources. Until next time, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters.